Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the testimony today from Brett Kavanaugh, where he obfuscated tough questions from Senate Democrats with layers of lofty legalism, while being handed groveling softball questions from Republicans about how his kids feel about the way the hearings are going. Paul Campos, a professor at the University of Colorado Law School and author of Jurismania, The Madness of American Law, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, joins us to discuss the fatuous nature of this political theater in which one side plays hardball and the other fumes in impotence. And while Kavanaugh's confirmation appears to be a foregone conclusion, there were hints of questions from Senator Leahy that the nominee may have been less than truthful about the hacking of Leahy's email, which, if pursued, might tip the scales. But given the lockstep nature of the Republicans on the committee and the determination to get Kavanaugh's confirmation as a trophy for the GOP base before the election, it is doubtful that anything short of a video of Kavanaugh drowning kittens or cavorting with Satan would derail the confirmation of Trump's second justice onto the Supreme Court, in part because of the saturation of scandal fatigue from the constant outrages of our porn star-prone president. Then we'll look into the possible political effect of Bob Woodward's new book, Fear, Trump in the White House, which is already getting enormous media attention ahead of its publication next Tuesday. Paul Fahey, the Washington Post media reporter, joins us to discuss the difference between Woodward's book and earlier exposés of a chaotic and dysfunctional White House, and whether the shocking revelations about a president who himself is a threat to our national security could move the needle in terms of influencing Trump's base inside the Fox News bubble. Then finally, with hearings today before the Senate Intelligence Committee, at which the CEOs of Facebook and Twitter testified about Russian election interference and data manipulation, propaganda, and hate speech on social media, we will speak with Jared Holt, a research associate at Right Wing Watch, who specializes in alt-right and so-called new right media and the influence of the right wing in social media. He joins us to discuss the altercation outside the hearing room between Senator Marco Rubio and the conspiracy theorist and hate monger Alex Jones. And joining us now is Paul Campos, who's a professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He writes for both popular and academic audiences and has been a vocal critic of the American legal system in numerous articles and essays and in books such as Against the Law and Jurismania, The Madness of American Law. And he blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Campos.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thank you, Paul. And today, of course, there was more of Kavanaugh in these hearings, and it's kind of ridiculous. On the one side, the Democrats are complaining about the lack of documentation and attacking him on his record, at least what they have of his record. But on the other side, the Republicans are just, you know, asking these ridiculous softball questions, you know, I understand, Judge Kavanaugh, you like little puppies, you know. Mm-hmm. Lindsey Graham going on about how he fed the homeless Kavanaugh. And then Graham gets into this whole thing about how we used to confirm Supreme Court justices that Scalia was 96-0 or something, 96-4, and all of them were in the 90s. But what happened, he said plaintively, what's happened to us? Well, I felt like I was screaming at the TV saying, what happened was Merrick Garland, for God's sake. I mean, I couldn't believe the selective nature of the way the Republicans see this candidate, but not in the context of the kind of thuggish behavior of Mitch McConnell.
Well, yes. I mean, it's obviously extremely hypocritical, even by political standards. And it's also farcical, short of some genuine bombshell revelation, which, by the way, I don't think is out of the question, certainly from what Senator Leahy was hinting around about in regard to possible lying on Kavanaugh's part in regard to hacked emails and the like. There could still be some kind of bombshell revelation. But short of that, Obviously, we know what's going to happen here, and this is just all a kind of a pointless theater, and it's difficult to take seriously.
But as a law professor, can you explain to us what this, when he's asked by Dick Durbin about decisions he made protecting some really disgusting employer who was ripping off these undocumented workers, and Durbin was accusing him of not following the law, and he gave this incredibly complicated answer that suggested he was following the law. So what is it about that distance between the human consequences of what you do, which is screw over a bunch of people and defend some real scumbag, and the majesty of the law that you're upholding? I don't get it.
I think part of what's happening in this kind of a situation is that people like Kavanaugh like to argue that the very fact that they are upholding really reprehensible behavior as legal is itself evidence that they are dispassionate interpreters and decision makers, because they wouldn't be doing this if they were just working from a clean slate, but that they're constrained by the legal materials to rule in the way they are. Now, I think Kavanaugh is tremendously exaggerating the extent to which he's actually constrained in this way. And part of what's going on is that people like him simply aren't nearly as disturbed by the kinds of cases that Durbin was describing as, you know, Kavanaugh and his ilk, i.e., you know, Federalist Society right-wing judges are. So what we're seeing here are really two different political conceptualizations of what it is to be a judge, but Kavanaugh's conceptualization is just as political as a liberal view of what a judge is supposed to be doing. So, you know, in a sense, there could be a kind of educational value in this sort of a hearing, but it's to me, it's just overwhelmed by the posturing, and especially by the incredible hypocrisy of the Republicans in this kind of a situation, which, as you mentioned, just sort of overwhelms everything else.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Campos, who is a professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He writes for both popular and academic audiences and has been a vocal critic of the American legal system in numerous articles and essays, and in his books such as Against the Law and Jurismania, The Madness of American Law. And he blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Well, even Senator Feinstein, who's the champion of abortion rights and also the champion of gun control, she went after him on Roe v. Wade. She didn't really get anywhere. And she didn't even mention the case with the young immigrant woman, 17-year-old, who got pregnant. And two of the three judges allowed her to have an abortion, as did the state of Texas. But Kavanaugh ruled against her having an abortion. I know one of the other senators, I think it was Durbin, picked up on it. But I was astounded that they weren't really focusing on real-life cases where he made rulings that really tip his hand, the extent to which he can't wait to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, that's clearly what's going on. But the Democrats are under current conditions powerless to stop it. And I just hope that this gets remembered the next time that there is a Supreme Court nomination and the Democrats, you know, have a majority in the Senate. They need to be completely ruthless and as disciplined as the Republicans have been, and recognize that the Republicans have managed to essentially hijack one of the three branches of government through procedures which until very recently would have been considered utterly unacceptable, i.e. the blocking of Merrick Garland's nomination. That's where we are now. And we can just dispense with the, in my view, naive fiction that Supreme Court nominations are anything but pure power politics, and all of this blabbering about, you know, qualifications and you know, how brilliant this guy is and like what schools he went to, none of that stuff matters. The only thing that matters is what political vision does the nominee have of the law, and whether that's shared by the elected officials who have to make the decision to whether to put him on the court for a lifetime appointment or not.
Well, as I say, I was disappointed in Senator Feinstein, but it did. I think Durbin did at least pick up. And again, even though it was so clear the situation that this young woman was in, and Durbin kept saying the clock is ticking, and you're holding up her possibility of having an abortion until it becomes too late. And on the basis of what? And the Texas law has supported her, and the other two judges on the appeals court supported her, and why didn't you? And for the life of me, I do not understand what his argument was. But again, it was all couched in the sort of lofty Byzantine nature of jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But people need to keep their eye on the ball here. Their eye on the ball is this is a right-wing, neo-Confederate, reactionary judge who's being put on a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court because this seat was stolen from Merrick Garland. That's the only thing that matters. And all of the nonsensical arguments about his the fine points of his judicial philosophy are quite marginal. And so I guess we have to go through this charade. I'm personally hoping that Senator Leahy was hinting around that he might have some big revelation. Maybe something like that can happen. But short of that, he's going to be confirmed and he's going to be on the Supreme Court probably for 30 or 40 years. And this kind of absurdly unwieldy system that we've created in regard to Supreme Court nominations and tenure will continue to be a real blight on the American political system.
Well, I'm told that there's some of the staffers on the Democratic judiciary side, but they're being blocked by both Schumer and Feinstein, who don't want to go there. It sort of reminds me of what happened with Joe Biden, stopped the second witness from testifying to buttress Anita Hill's claim after the Republicans had trashed Anita Hill. Had somebody stepped up and said, yeah, the same thing happened to me, Thomas would never have been on the court. And he only got on the court by a one-vote margin, I think. Was it 50-49, something like that? Pretty much what's going to happen with Kavanaugh. So, the Leahy thing, I guess it seemed a little like he was hinting at it, but I don't know whether they're going to go for the full-throated. I mean, it gets down to the real questions about people like Schumer, who represents Wall Street. At what point do we get rid of these gutless centrists and have real Democrats?
Right. I agree. And I guess we're going to find out. I think the Democrats are slowly coming to their senses in regard to what has actually happened. It's taken a long, long time for them to come to the realization that the Republican Party plays power politics, period. It doesn't care about anything else. And its agenda right now is largely controlled by the white ethno-nationalism that put Donald Trump in office. And that's what's going on. And it's a kind of existential crisis in regard to the identity of this nation going forward. And Supreme Court nominations are, in my view, unfortunately, large factor in this ongoing crisis, simply because we have this, frankly, anachronistic and unjustifiable system of lifetime tenure for Supreme Court justices.
Well, you have to add to this the fact that structurally we're heading into a situation where the Republicans will control the Senate and therefore the courts indefinitely, because by the year 2040, because about 15, 16 states will have most of the population of this country, mostly blue mm-hmm. states, you'll have 70 Republican senators from the red states and only 30 Democrat senators from the blue states, where most of the population is. And we learned from the last election that the 3 million extra votes of Hillary Clinton got didn't mean a damn thing. So that's just going to get worse over the years. The popular vote is going to go to the Democrats, and the Senate is going to be solidly in Republican hands.
Right. Well, I mean, I do believe in the long term, the U.S. has got to get rid of having an unrepresentative legislature in the Senate, and it's got to get rid of the Electoral College, which is also very deeply anti-democratic. You can't have democratic legitimacy if you keep getting anti-democratic results from your elections. That seems extremely basic and straightforward. But again, I think a lot of people are having difficulty coming to terms with the actual situation in that regard.
Well, Paul Campos, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Campos, who's a professor at the University of Colorado Law School. He writes for both popular and academic audiences and has been a vocal critic of the American legal system in numerous articles and essays and in his books such as Against the Law and Jurismania, The Madness of American Law. And he blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with the question of whether the shocking revelations in Woodward's new book will impact Trump's base. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Paul Fahrey, who is the Washington Post media reporter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Fahrey.
Thanks for having me.
And Bob Woodward's the associate editor, right, of the Washington Post?
Yes, I think it's, he is. It's more or less a ceremonial title. He doesn't have day-to-day responsibilities, right. But he has always been associated with the paper ever since he worked here as a reporter.
So his book is now headline news across the media. It was the lead story on the Nightly News last night, the network Nightly News, and it's not going to be published till Tuesday. So I imagine throughout this weekend we're going to be seeing a lot of Bob Woodward, right?
Very much so, although I think his only scheduled TV appearance has been an interview with CBS Sunday Morning, which will air on Sunday, so kind of a long time between now and then. But yes, you'll see plenty of file footage of him and interviews that he has done over the years.
And the two reporters, Phil Rucker and Bob Costa, they were given access to the book. Has anybody else been able to read the book at the Post?
I don't know the answer to that. Phil and Bob certainly did. They've had it for several days. Bob said he, in fact, read it twice. It's likely that others here have read it, but I'm not sure about that. CNN was also given a copy, and I don't know exactly the source of that. I assume it's the publisher or someone close to the publisher. A friendly bookseller. Nevertheless, very, very limited amount of exposure until publication date.
So already the president is calling the book boring, untrue. Then he goes on to suggest that why don't Washington politicians change the libel laws? So God help us if that's the the result of this expose on this dysfunctional White House.
Well, of course, that's a hollow or empty threat. First of all, Trump doesn't control the libel laws. That's something for the courts. And, there are Supreme Court decisions that would have to be overturned before the libel laws were really, truly changed. The basic principles are embedded in the law. You don't just go around monkeying with them and messing with them. And so, that's just Trump being Trump.
Well, it's also Trump displaying an enormous ignorance of the very foundation of this country because of the American Revolution was largely fought against the British libel laws that still exist today in the UK. And the reason why the US has the most liberal, if you will, libel laws is because of the First Amendment was the first. It's not called the First Amendment by accident, surely.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And, of course, the most consequential Supreme Court decision on libel, Sullivan versus New York Times, was in the mid-1960s, I believe. So this has been pretty much settled law for decades and decades. And, you know, it's sort of like Trump's threats to sue somebody over one or other story or book or account that he doesn't like. He can say it all he wants, but he never actually gets around to doing it. And it's the same way with his threat to open up the libel laws or even to yank licenses of networks that he doesn't like. These are empty threats. There's still three branches of government, and he only controls one of them.
Well, to some extent, I was just reading the transcript and listening to the one tape that Bob Woodward has put out, and that is his conversation with President Trump. And it's extraordinary. It's almost like pulling back the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. Trump spends most of this conversation basically lying about why Woodward wasn't given an interview and passing the buck. And they even bring in Kellyanne Conway. And she said, well, yeah, it's true. You did ask me for it. And I don't know what happened. And it's extraordinary that that's the focus of the most powerful office in the land.
Well, you know, I read it the same way. And on one hand, he says he never learned of Woodward's request for an interview. And on the other hand, he says, oh, yeah, you know what? Lindsey Graham did tell me about that and did mention that you were hoping to speak to me. And Kellyanne Conway doesn't add very much. She says, we passed that request on. She doesn't say to whom. She doesn't say anything more than that request was either disappeared or denied, but the whole exercise does seem like a dog chasing its tail. It goes round and round. Trump apparently did know. If he acted on it, it wasn't with a great deal of urgency. The bottom line is he never got to speak to Woodward and vice versa. And, you know, my question about that is how much difference would it have made? It would have made some, because at least Trump would have been on the record saying the things he's now saying, which is so much of what you're reporting is untrue. But beyond that, I don't think it would have stopped Woodward from reporting what he reported. It just would be a contrary voice.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Fahey, who's the Washington Post media reporter. But Woodward's got tapes. What is the woman who transcribed it? Hundreds of hours, is that right?
Yes.
She briefly joined the conversation with the president. So
No, you're confusing a couple of things. Woodward's tapes were transcribed by his own personal assistant, not the White House assistant. The White House assistant that Trump is referring to is a White House personal assistant, different person.
Oh, Evelyn.
Yes.
Oh, that's
Evelyn is Bob's personal assistant. The other young lady that Trump is referring to works in the White House.
I see. So I thought, maybe I misread it, I thought Evelyn joined the conversation. Evelyn Duffy. Yeah.
Yes, and she works for Woodward.
Right, but she did join the conversation with the president, saying that she transcribed the tapes hundreds of hours. So that's the big shoe that maybe won't drop. I mean, it's no surprise to me that the people that Woodward said called Trump an idiot and called the White House crazy town, General Kelly and Mattis, who says it's like talking to a fifth or sixth grader, they, of course, have ritually denied saying what they said. But surely that shouldn't be a surprise, right? I mean, if they said, yeah, we said it, they'd be out the door in a second, right? And what's implied, I think, from this dysfunctional White House that Woodward's exposing is that, thank God, there's a couple of adults. She may not agree with the very right-wing politics of General Kelly, but without him, the deluge, right?
Yeah, you know, sources often backtrack after they are exposed or their words are exposed or they try to claim deniability. It's fairly typical. You know, I mean, part of this is the secondhand nature of it. They didn't necessarily say these things directly to Woodward. These were conversations recounted by people they did say it to, telling Woodward about those conversations. So there's a secondhand quality to some of this. You know, when people see their words presented to them, in any case, they're often surprised by what they said. In this case, you have a secondhand filter, which might, in the game of telephone that often occurs, might distort it somewhat. But I think the thrust of what's being said here is pretty consistent with things that have been said previously in other books, in other articles, and elsewhere. You know, there might be some argument over whether the words were crazy town or some other characterization, but we know from consistent reporting that this is how a number of White House officials do feel. So it's in some sense not a surprise.
Well, his partner from the Watergate days, Carl Bernstein, has already been attacked rather relentlessly by President Trump, and now President Trump is turning his ire towards Bob Woodward. At the end of the day, with all the tapes to back up what he said, what do you think is going to come out of this in terms? Actually, I think the key surely would be, since it's been very difficult for the Republicans in the House and Senate to be critical in any way of Trump, in spite of many, many outrages that have been shared across the board, they still remain pretty silent. The assumption is they're afraid of their base and afraid of angering them because the House is up for re-election and a third of the Senate is. That's the excuse that we're given. Yep. But the people inside the base are fairly lockstep. And so would this move the needle at all in terms of those two groups that have been reluctant and who believe, in the case of the base, they believe that what you guys do at the Washington Post is fake news, and the Republicans, I don't know how you want to characterize them, but so far, you know, Paul Ryan and others have been pretty timid.
Yeah, my guess is, and it's just that a guess, is it won't move the needle much at all. Look at everything that has happened over the past 18 months, from, you know, his response to Puerto Rico to foreign policy, trade, what have you. None of those things have truly moved the needle. It moves up within and down within a very narrow range. So I don't think one book, which, by the way, is a lot like several previous books, a little more extreme, but like those previous books, I doubt that this will make that much difference. Trump's support is extremely strong among a certain group, whether it's 36%, whether it's 42%, it's somewhere in that range, and it kind of stays in that range. Lately, it took a little leg downward, but not significant and not particularly. You know, if the base was not outraged by, for instance, the policy of separating families at the border, you know, the real question is what is going to outrage them, and they're pretty much behind the president.
Well, what I find puzzling, though, Paul Fahey, is that you say there have been other books, but I think this is the most solid and most alarming because it deals with the very nature of the presidency and the highest responsibility of the presidency being national security. And you get a real distinct picture of dangerous dysfunction and a president who, in the words of General Mattis, his Secretary of Defense, is dangerously ignorant and thinks like a fifth or a sixth grader. You know, the other book, Fire and Fury, was pretty gossipy, just about the personalities. This is about some of the biggest issues you can imagine. And the idea that Gary Cohn could swipe a document off the desk in order to stop a war in the Korean Peninsula, and that the president didn't even notice that it was gone, is just incredibly alarming. So, you know, a lot of those people inside the Trump bubble believe in the military, and et cetera. So you'd think that from the national security point of view, it may start to raise some eyelids.
Well, I would say you have to get more into the psychology of why the people who are serving in this administration are serving in this administration. And one theory, again, just a theory, is that they, A, are patriotic and want to serve the country. They also believe generally in Trump's program, but also they can be interpreted as people who want to prevent something bad from happening, and that they are standing in the way, that only through their judgment and their actions are preventing more extreme and terrible things from happening. So I think that's part of it. That's why someone would stay on the job, because if it weren't them, something worse might happen. And, the New York Times just put out a very interesting op-ed written anonymously. The headline is, "I am part of the resistance inside the Trump administration." It's written by a senior official whose name we don't know, and the Times is not disclosing, which explains some of this psychology. There are good people in the government. But part of that being good people means we don't want to see the country do badly, and we don't want bad things to happen, even if the judgment from the top is flawed.
Well, that's the last line in the exchange between Woodward and Trump in the tape that was released.
Yes, and it also showed you the disparity between how Trump sees his presidency and maybe some of the people who are resistant to it. Trump believes he's doing a great job and that everything he's done has been successful, and others disagree, let's just put it that way.
Right. Well, I think in a way, particularly the military types, since they're nonpartisan, or they try to be, I see Trump in many ways a kind of continuum of Sarah Palin, who apparently the late John McCain considered the worst mistake he made. In other words, you get somebody in high office that's just woefully unqualified and doesn't know what they're doing. From the point of view of the professionals, like General Mattis, they probably say, well, this is what American democracy handed us, right? So we just have to deal with it, right?
Sure.
Is that your understanding?
Well, that's right. I mean, he was duly elected. He was apparently fairly elected, and he is the president. He does have the authority. But you know, I think part of this exposes the difference between, you know, a straight up order and a guy blowing off steam. All presidents blow off steam, say things they later regret. And there's a certain amount of interpretation that one can apply between he doesn't really mean it, like, for instance, suggesting, as Woodward reports, that the military should assassinate Bashar al-Assad, between a guy blowing off steam and actually giving a direct order. So there is a certain gray area there, and I think that's what, you know, the people under him are counting on, that it was a spur-of-the-moment comment. He didn't necessarily mean it, and he's not going to the mat about it. So we're not going to carry out any orders because we don't think they're orders in the first place.
Right, but I've spoken to people that worked in many White Houses, and going back to Jimmy Carter, who was a a church deacon and pretty sober guy. Apparently, the one time in his 4 years in the White House that he really lost it and was just furious was when he learned that Fidel Castro had dumped all these criminals on the United States, and he really went ballistic, but didn't order the the Air Force to drop bombs. The impression I get from Woodward's book is that Trump is volatile most of the time, angry a lot of the time. He's even kind of admitted that he gives his staff a hard time. So my sense is that this is a different order of magnitude in terms of somebody that's volatile.
Well, I'd also say that keep an eye on this program because I think we're going to see departures, firings, you know, a clean sweep, what have you. He's done this all along, and I think after the election especially, you're going to see some people leaving the White House. So whether, you know, he claims these statements are untrue or not, I think there is a sense within the White House and the administration that some people are at odds with him, some people don't like him, and he doesn't like them, and we'll see what occurs and what happens with White House staffing. He's been purging people all along, going back to Reince Priebus and Michael Flynn and on and on and on. So it's going to continue happening.
Right, but just in closing, it could get worse in terms of dysfunction, because if you get rid of the sober professionals like General Mattis and you bring in sycophants and toadies, then that just enables Trump's worst behavior.
Yes. One of the ironies of the last couple of weeks is liberals coming to the aid and defense of Jeff Sessions, a man who they would never defend when he was a very conservative senator, but is now under siege as the attorney general because Trump has been after him for recusing himself in the Russia probe. The tables turn on this one. But I think that's probably the betting here in town is that Jeff Sessions will probably be the former attorney general after the election, and Trump will bring in his own guy and a sycophant. And yes, I do think it could be dangerous. I do think you always need, in any management anywhere, people to bring ideas and not be afraid of disagreement. If all you want is someone who's going to be a yes man or a yes woman, you're probably not getting the best advice.
Well, Paul Fahari, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Fahari, who's the Washington Post media reporter. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the policing of hate speech online. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jared Holt, who's a research associate at Right Wing Watch, a project of People for the American Way. He previously tracked and provided analysis on fringe media for Media Matters for America and specializes in alt-right and so-called new-right media, in addition to the larger culture and influence of right-wing social media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Holt.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Jared. And this wasn't so much right-wing media on social media was on display today or under investigation before the Senate Intelligence Committee, but it was the executives of both Twitter and Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg and Jack Dorsey. They basically told the senators who were concerned about Russian influence in the elections from the last election and going into this 2018 election, but it doesn't look as if they got many concessions, if any, from the executives of Facebook and Twitter. And, of course, Google didn't even show up. So what was your reading on it? Because basically what Sandberg and Dorsey are saying is that they'll fight these inauthentic accounts like the Russian trolls and bots, but they won't ban conspiracy theorists and propaganda.
Yeah, so today's hearings were a whole lot of the same thing we've been seeing at prior hearings on this subject, which is that these tech companies come to these hearings, they face a lot of questions, but they don't seem to have a whole lot of concrete answers. And I think that's kind of what has fueled the frustration with platforms like Twitter and Facebook and et cetera, is that these companies have pledged to consumers that they are going to clean up the platforms to make them safer, to cut down on misinformation, and make it at least more difficult for bad actors or foreign governments to interfere with democracy on the platforms. And I'm afraid today, as I was watching this hearing, I felt like I was experiencing a bit of deja vu from prior hearings.
So what do you make of Google not showing? I mean, Senator Marco Rubio said they were either arrogant or unwilling to face tough questioning. Was the questioning that tough, do you think?
I don't think the questioning was really too tough, to be quite frank. I think that, you know, some senators and representatives had sort of important questions that have been asked for the last couple of years of these platforms, namely, you know, trying to get some concrete answers on the way that they plan to enforce these, you know, promises that they've made to consumers, but have failed to do so to this point in a way that is clearly tangible and is reassuring. And then the other half, a few GOP members of Congress reiterated these conspiracy theories about, you know, alleging that these companies have discriminated against conservatives on the platform in some way. As far as Google not showing, I, you know, imagining how the last ones went, I believe that was in July, it seemed to, you know, come across as a bit of a circus. A lot of the questioning from members of Congress felt a bit performative and less substantial. So I can imagine that Google would not want to subjugate itself to another round of that.
Right. But Google and Facebook, their business model is known as surveillance capitalism. So they're not going to give up on their business model, are they? So they're trying to sort of suggest that Cambridge Analytica's use of their data was an aberration. That's what it's all about, isn't it? Basically, the user who thinks they're getting Gmail for free is actually, they become the product.
Right. That's the whole business model. You know, because these companies dominate the web in such a major way, you know, and they are still private businesses. So they are motivated primarily by their bottom line. And, you know, because of that, we've seen not just the Cambridge Analytica stuff, but it came out recently that Facebook was selling information to banks and that sort of thing. So there's not a real financial incentive for them to act swiftly or, you know, to the degree that I would imagine that many consumers would desire that they do.
Now, in this hearing today before the Senate Intelligence Committee, where the CEOs of Facebook and Twitter testified, in the audience were Alex Jones and this guy Charles Johnson, an internet troll who's been banned from Twitter for threatening to take out a Black Lives Matter activist. And, of course, this other woman, Laura Loomer, another alt-right activist. And there was in a break, when Marco Rubio left the hearing room, he was confronted by Alex Jones, who heckled him. And then at one point, Alex Jones put his hand on Senator Rubio's shoulder. So let's just play the clip of that exchange.
Well, I think the bigger bias is against freedom of expression. Everybody should be. There's a look, I support
here.
Going
it's
after.
Happening here, but you say I don't exist.
Is that a heckler or a press gaggle?
Look at this guy. He's saying that I don't exist, and they're
I just don't know who you are, man. I don't read your websites.
Sure, and they demonize me in these very hearings, and then he plays dumb.
Here's the question.
Infowars.com, you know what it is.
Does Google, does Facebook, does Twitter, do they need to be regulated like, do they need to be regulated?
Marco Rubio the snake.
This is dumbass.
Boy here.
All right, man.
Yeah.
Who are you, man? Who is this guy? I swear to God, I don't know who you are, man.
You better hope you can deplatform me. Tens of millions of views.
Infowars.
Bigger than Rush Limbaugh. He knows who InfoWars is. Playing this joke over here. That's why the deplatforming didn't work.
But here's the question. Here's the question.
Wait, don't touch me again, man. I'm asking you not to touch me.
Well, sure. I just patted you nicely.
I know, but I don't
want
to be. I don't know
you, man.
I don't know who you are.
It's not just
you're not
going to
get arrested,
amendment.
Man. You're not going to get arrested. I'll take care of it myself.
Oh, he'll beat me up.
I didn't say
you
that.
You didn't know who I am, but he's so mad. You're not going to silence me. You're not going to silence America.
Well, but there are people.
You are literally like a little gangster thug.
There are people in this country.
Rubio just threatened to physically take care of me.
There are people who feel that they are being.
And that was, of course, an exchange that took place today in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing room in the corridor, where a group of reporters were talking with Senator Marco Rubio. And I guess the point that Marco Rubio made in that clip Jared, is an important one, where he basically says about after having been called a frat boy and a gangster and a thug and snake-like, except by Alex Jones, he then turned to the reporter and said, "You guys take care of this clown. You guys take care of this clown." And then he told the reporters, "I know you've got to cover them, but you give these guys way too much attention. We're making crazy people superstars, so we are going to get crazier people." I think that's an important point that Rubio is making. And here you and I, we're talking about Alex Jones, for God's sake. So how do you deal with this phenomenon of these horrible trolls at the same time not give them oxygen?
Yeah, that's something, that's sort of the existential question of, frankly, the work that I do. It's a way of making sure that, these bad actors are held accountable for their actions and that their influence in the broader media sphere and political sphere is made public, while at the same time not giving undue attention. So, the way I parse that when I approach my work, Alex Jones is quite a newsworthy figure, I believe, primarily because of his relationship to the president, having hosted Trump when he was a candidate in 2015, and have claiming on air that he is sending documents to the White House and speaking with people in the Pentagon and stuff. If we are to believe that is all true, and at least sending the documents part is, he's worth covering because somebody who is as unhinged and, a bit off the wall as he is, having influence on the levers of power in this country, is incredibly newsworthy. And it's worth, really laying out who he is and what he believes. When it comes to other ones, I also feel that oftentimes the influence of these sort of far right-wing internet trolls and the communities that they have online can often go understated, whether it is 4chan, the anonymous online message board, or it's simply Twitter campaigns and hashtag campaigns. They do have the ability that they've fine-tuned quite well to be able to steer conversation and mainstream conservative circles. And I think the fact that these hearings, the fact that GOP members of Congress are talking about shadow banning and, censorship of conservatives online, something that was born in the circles online inhabited by these conspiracy theorists, speaks volumes to the sort of influence that they can actually have.
Well, the Florida Republican Representative Matt Gaetz has actually championed this character, this Chuck Johnson guy. I mean, this guy's obviously this Tea Party Republican. I've seen him on TV a lot. But there's no question that Alex Jones has a fan in the Oval Office. Just the other day when Trump made his weird tweet about Google attacking the algorithms, basically saying that Google's not giving the right-wing media a fair shake and that the so-called fake news is dominating the Google searches. Of course, Google tried to be rational and say, no, well, it's an algorithm we're talking about. These aren't necessarily, there's no bias involved. But then later in the day, at a photo opportunity, he said on camera, Trump, a lot of people are really angry about censoring these conservative talk. He went on, and he was championing Alex Jones. There was no way that he wasn't talking about anybody else but Alex Jones. So my understanding is that Alex Jones and some of these other guys like Johnson and this woman, Laura Loomer, they're claiming now they're attacking the chief of staff of the White House, General Kelly. They're saying he's stopping this stuff getting to Trump's desk. Well, I tend to believe that. That's one of the only times I believe Alex Jones, frankly.
Yeah, and I think that is probably, not the worst thing that Kelly could do, to be honest. As someone who has watched thousands of hours of InfoWars, I am of the personal inclination that it would be better if we didn't have this in the Oval Office, but here we are.
Well, but you were involved in getting Jones taken off Spotify. And Spotify, their statement about InfoWars is that the reason they're banning it is InfoWars expressly and principally promotes, advocates, and incites hatred or violence against a group or individuals based on characteristics, not because of his speech, but because of his hate speech. And if you've been watching hundreds of hours of this guy, and I have great sympathy for you as a result of that, what is really disgraceful about this guy is what he did to the families of Sandy Hook. I mean, imagine losing your child in kindergarten and can't even bury the kid because these assault rifles just blew their bodies apart. Then you find you're being harassed by Alex Jones's acolytes coming to the house and saying that you're a part of some government conspiracies to take away people's firearms. And then you have to move seven times to get away from these people. And then eventually you have to sue Alex Jones, which is what's going on now with the family of Sandy Hook. I mean, talk about people being punished after having salt rubbed in the wound of the unspeakable wound of losing a child. I just find that about the most despicable thing you can imagine.
Yeah, and, you know, other common themes on InfoWars is very vicious and gross attacks on LGBT people, specifically most recently against people who self-identify as being transgender. Jones also encourages his audience to take up arms, buy weapons, and get ready for a civil war that is, you know, going to happen between the so-called deep state or against the media or against just liberals at large. And, you know, all of this in tandem creates a very toxic contribution to the discourse that, you know, as we've seen after Sandy Hook and, you know, David Hogg, the young man who survived the Parkland shooting, who took up the cause of gun reform. He had his house was called swatted, where people call in a police raid, and that's incredibly dangerous. So it's not necessarily, you know, Alex Jones wasn't shut down because he's a dissident voice. He was shut down because he incites hatred that has frequently bled out into the real world and caused, you know, serious harm and damage to the people that he targets.
Well, but this is where you go back to Trump, who clearly is a fan of Jones's. And his statement the other day in the White House in defense of Jones and against the people, Facebook. And by the way, Facebook only suspended him for a month. Twitter suspended him for a week, I think. You know, it's like a rather mild punishment for an errant school child. But what Jones is saying and what Trump is saying, Trump keeps saying people are really angry, people are really angry. Well, he's talking about Jones's people. They're really angry about what's happening. And then he goes, and then Trump talks about how the liberals are going to create violence after the elections. He's laying the groundwork for this lunatic fringe led by Jones and all these heavily armed people to believe that's, you know, this seems like Trump's hedge against impeachment, that he's going to unleash these crazy right-wing gun-toting conspiracy theorists on the imaginary assault by liberals.
Right. It's, I think especially as the investigation with special counsel Robert Mueller is starting to sort of pick up and snare some indictments. We had the Manafort and Cohen news the other day. We've seen this White House, and specifically Trump himself, scratch the itch of sort of the fringier elements of his base. I think this is just another example. It was hard for me to interpret the president's comments as anything other than catering to a conspiracy theory that has now worked its way into Republican fundraising pitches and conferences and radio shows and whatnot. Because I think framing this as a battle, or, you know, Trump kind of came in saying he was battling the establishment. Well, now that he is the establishment and he holds high office, he has to find someone new to go to battle with to keep this narrative going. And it seems like they've picked tech companies and sided with some of the loonier aspects of the base to get that energy going.
But the latest stuff that Jones is propagating, which you've written about, Jared Holt, Alex Jones claims he's a super-duper secret agent. He's pushing this idea of a stay-behind network that's connected to the Pentagon. And this is their way of distinguishing themselves, these far-right gun-toting loonies, from the deep state that both Trump and Alex Jones and others castigate and are obsessed with. So it seems like what they've come up with is this idea of the alternative to the deep state. In other words, the deep state within the deep state, which they call the stay-behind network.
Yeah, the super-duper deep state, if you will.
So tell us about this theory, because, again, we shouldn't be giving this guy oxygen, but I think he's dangerous, and I think Trump is dangerous, and I think together they're extremely dangerous, and they're talking about stuff and they're hinting at stuff that could get real ugly if this election turns ugly, which it might well. If the Russians interfere, there's going to be a lot of angry people. So we could be heading into some very, very difficult period here, and I just see this as signaling, just as the way he signaled by pardoning the Bundys, you know, not the, well, the other characters from the wildlife refuges that he pardoned, and pardoning Arpaio. He's making it clear whose side he is, Donald Trump is. And again, he is unmistakably siding with a dangerous lunatic fringe.
Yeah, so the stay-behind network stuff, this is a callback to programs in the 1950s that various militaries created to embed within countries and be sort of a type of militia that would activate if a Soviet invasion were to happen. And this lines up with Jones' sort of bread and butter talking points, which is that a wave of communism and, you know, ushered in by socialism is coming to America, and that is what is responsible for the so-called deep state, or, you know, he blames the Chinese government and, in addition to communism, that for what he sees as tech censorship, or what he's claimed as censorship. So this is framing in the idea of the InfoWars listeners that they, you know, will have some sort of justification, or that they have been chosen or selected, or they are part of an exclusive group of people who, you know, could be authorized to rise up in some sort of violent fashion if, you know, the alarm bell is sounded, which is incredibly dangerous.
Somebody should tell Jones that the Chinese leadership are a bunch of capitalists. Well, Jared, I thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jared Holt, who's a research associate at Right Wing Watch, a project of People for the American Way. He previously tracked and provided an analysis on fringe media for Media Matters of America and specializes in alt-right and so-called new-right media, in addition to the larger culture and influence of right-wing social media. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.